Welcome at Planetary Health Talks, the podcast in which we invite professionals and enthusiasts in the field of planetary health. We discuss its importance, interconnectedness, and application in our everyday lives. This podcast is presented to you by the Knowledge Center Global Health, hosted by Ashish Brahma, that's me, and co-hosted by
Renee Robbers, that's me.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is another episode of Planetary Health Talks. I am your host, Ashish Brahma, public health physician for a long, long time. And I have some very nice people with me in the studio. That's Renee Robbers, who's going to ask some questions, right?
Yes, definitely.
And Tessa, who is focusing on the sound quality. Hi, Tessa. We have in Utrecht a very, very special opportunity to talk with Dr. Lika Ratan, and we are very curious to hear who this doctor actually is, because I read a wonderful CV, and if she's shy, I will enhance and tell her who she really is. So don't be shy and tell who you are, doctor.
Hi, everyone. My name is Dr. Lika Ratan. I am an Indian physician. I was born in Mumbai. And I also did a tropical medicine specialization, and I work in implementation science and non-communicable diseases right now. And my connection with Planetary Health is that I co-chair a working group of young doctors from around the world, with the World Medical Association, on planetary health, previously called Climate Change and Health.
That's wonderful, doctor. And that actually shows that we have a lot of things in common, because I also did Tropical Medicine International Health. I think you studied in Utrecht. I studied in London. But we have very similar interests. So that's very nice. Yet another doctor to speak about planetary health. But there's also a lot of interesting topics that you've dropped so far. But I'm just going to pass you by some of the terms that I read in your CV. And that's talking about humanitarian crises. And what's the relationship for you between planetary health and humanitarian crises?
Like I said earlier, I was born in Mumbai. And Mumbai is a city that is affected by natural disasters. We have a lot of external migration, which ends up bringing in a lot of people from around the country who end up living in urban dwellings that are not, that are slum dwellings, and people cannot possibly live in such settings. I used to be a first responder during my time as a school student, and also after I became a doctor. In any and all kinds of crisis situations, like, for example, floods, cyclones or storms. And there used to be a lot of floods every year during monsoon. And that's how I became more acquainted with crisis situations, first in my own community. And then when I looked outwards, I saw that it was a recurring occurrence in other parts of the world as well. And with planetary health, I think that as we keep going beyond planetary boundaries, natural disasters, violence, conflict is going to become a way of life and cause an increase in humanitarian crises around the world, as we're already seeing in some parts of the world right now.
Yeah,
Does that answer your question, Ashish?
Yes, absolutely. And what it says to me is a very similar story. I worked in India also, but I also worked in Africa. And what you see is that many farmers flee to the city because of droughts, violent spells, conflict over natural resources. Even in India, this is the case. And so I think a lot of people in Europe may not exactly know what a slum is and what it entails. So could you describe how the, you know, of course there's different sort of slums, but what would a slum mean? What I would say is in Kampala, for example, they live in the area where usually the river runs off to the lake. So basically they're living in a swamp. Is that the same in Mumbai? And the second question is, how big is Mumbai actually? Like 20 million people?
Yeah, probably more. Mumbai is huge. There's a lot of people in Mumbai. I do not remember how many people we have officially. Probably more than 20 million.
Wow.
To have a good idea about what Islam is, but if I were to describe it briefly, I would say these are temporary houses. So these houses could be as small as just a small room, 20 by 20 meters, and there would be six people living in that small household all together. They would do everything in that small house that they call house, and it's stacked one about the other. If you go to this area called Bandra East, which is an area that that I used to pass by on my way to medical school, it's even worse because these houses are made out of plastic and stacked one above each other, and it's very difficult for people to live in such places, but they continue to do so. And the glaring, so in Bandra East, you see these houses, but if you go to Bandra West, you see these houses that cost like 100 million euro at least. And if you go further south in Mumbai, it becomes so clear how these, you know, the differences become super clear to you, but how people live in one city.
It sounds like a public health disaster waiting to happen or already happening. So what about infectious disease or non-communicable disease, healthy living patterns? Can you say something about that? Maybe not only about Mumbai, but refugee camps that you've studied around the world, or particularly about Mumbai, as you please.
Okay. So I could talk about refugee camps in Lesbos, in Greece, where I did my master thesis research.
Sure.
And these camps, well, they are, like you said, a public health disaster waiting to happen. If you look at these recent pictures that I'm seeing right now from early 2022, for example, I think it's quite similar to the slum dwellings that I see in Mumbai sometimes. And there's infectious diseases, water and sanitation, hygiene-related issues. And how are we supposed to tell people to wash their hands if they don't have any access to water?
Yeah, it's hard. Water wash disease, waterborne disease is rampant, and I work myself in refugee camps in several countries in Africa, but also in Asia.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you go through the numbers, and you've chosen a more policy and research side to yourself, and as you say, early stage research, I think you're already very accomplished. But what can we do? I mean, how does this all relate to what we're doing to the planet? Is there a link between how we are treating our planet and in the end, how people who are on the lower spectrum of life, who have less income, how we are treating them as society? Is there a link between the two?
I think there's definitely a link. And I think there's a link because the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer.
Yeah, that's tough to see, indeed, that capitalism works very well for the chosen few, and Marx was probably right saying that more and more of the outcome of hard labor ends up in the hands of less and less people. We see progress in the age that people become on the planet, yet we also see the divide growing daily. And so I want to park this issue and go back to something else, which is being half Indian and half Dutch myself. How do you feel that research from India or from Africa or from southern parts of America are being judged? Is is there the same respect for research and researchers from the global south and east vis-a-vis the research from the global north and west?
Yeah, a couple of years back, this movement started, the movement that's called Decolonizing Global Health, and in 2021, it gained a lot of momentum because, and one of the reasons was what you are talking about, that research in done in certain sections of societies or regions is not given as much respect as it deserves. And it also stems from prejudices and beliefs that people from some countries might have towards others. Let's see, another cause would be so there's a lot of helicopter research as well that goes on. Like I also felt it, you know. Whenever I went to, you know, another country that was not my own, I had this feeling that what am I doing here? Are the local health staff not enough to address these health problems?
Are you saying it's hard to grasp what, when you're not from a country, what actually is the underlying matrix, consciousness, the way that things work? It's hard to really look through from the eyes of a local person. Is that what you're saying? Is that what you're going towards?
Yeah, a little bit. Because I think a local person would have so much more context about what goes on. So for me, I would always feel like an outsider and even questioning myself if I have the right tools, if I know the correct knowledge to work in that setting. But in other settings, I've also felt more comfortable doing the same things. And I know a few of my colleagues have as well. So much so that they only put their names on research that they did in these countries, not the local staff. So that is a problem.
I get you. And I'm thinking about a saying in Africa, which is when the lions go hunting, it's not the antelopes that tell the tale of the hunt. Or to quote Edward Said, or the thoughts of Edward Said, history has been described by the winners, and the people that are standing by the wayside have less influence to tell the story, the narrative. Is that also an issue, that even though vast majority of the world live in the global south and east, yet the leading narrative is coming from the west?
It depends on what eyes you're viewing it from. For example, I was at this museum recently, and the curator there said that showed us a painting, which was a Dutch Indonesian painting from the revolt back in, I forget the year. And the Dutch people had these, they were painted as if they were protectors, and the indigenous people, the local people, were painted as devils. And the curator told us that it is the other way around if you go to the Indonesian Museum. And you can see how a lot of different history books and paintings have portrayed, you know, certain dark parts of history, depending on how you see it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I think I got lost in my head a little bit.
You didn't get lost at all. You actually triggered me to ask you the follow-up question about indigenous people in India, in New Zealand, in Australia, in Europe. We have given them a very, very hard and rough time. And what we see is that these peoples are, and in the United States, obviously, are actually very bad off when it comes to non-communicable disease, when it comes to addiction, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, when it comes to simple survival, suicide rates, people being put under pressure, heart, you know, what can go on, listing off all the diseases. And somehow it seems that they are left out. They were pushed out first from their lands, and now they're left out to get equal access, equity. So could you comment on that? How do you see that in India or the US or any country you could pick as an example?
If I look at it from like a climate change and health perspective, we are calling for inclusion of indigenous peoples who have been historically excluded. I think without planetary health movement as well, indigenous knowledge is so important. And I think how vulnerability of the so-called weakest section of the society is just becomes an important indicator of how well a community is doing. And if they're not doing well, then I don't know if the system is working.
Yeah. Some people would say how you judge what we perceive to be the weaker sex, old-fashioned as it is, the women or the children or elderly or indigenous people, that says something about the vibrancy and the beauty of your community. How inclusive is it? Can be measured about how you treat those people. I think the judgment is out. Which comes me to reach another point that I think you are very much involved in, and that is about youth. And we were talking a little bit before this interview about the role of the youth. And I always say we should live with seven generations past, the current generation, and the generations of the future. And I think you mentioned the alphas and the millennials and the Z and the Y generation. We should hand in hand work together. Could you comment on the role that youth have in this planetary health movement?
Yeah. I have an interesting anecdote, a recent anecdote. So I'm 27 years old. I am by no means old. I haven't crossed the 30 threshold yet, so I'm scared too. I was meeting a friend who's 30 recently, who was 18 years old, and they call themselves the Gen Z. And she told me about this app that they have. It's called Be Real. And with this app, you get a notification to take a selfie and tell your friends what you're doing every 3 to 4 hours in the day. But I had no idea. And this is just a girl who's like 8 years younger than me. And I thought I knew everything about the Gen Z. You know, I know they love BTS, which is a Korean boy band. We have a favorite boy band member. And this is Gen Z and my generation. And we're supposed to be millennials. And I still don't understand them.
So you're not into Korean pop, K-pop?
Oh, K-pop. Yeah, I know about all about K-pop because of my 12-year-old niece. And I love K-dramas. So I can go on and on about K-pop and K-drama with any 12-year-old or 13-year-old, you know. But I do not know about B-real. And if I think about, you know, how I am to talk to with a 40-year-old or a 50-year-old, I think I can see how it might be difficult for them to talk to me or vice versa. And coming back to climate change and planetary health, like we were talking about, I think as youth and in my position, I think I'm in a unique position to bring these different generations, like you said, seven up, seven down, all together and try and find common grounds because you know, people who are going to be alive 50 years from now need to be more involved in the conversation. And I think this is the time to be able to do it. It was just exciting as well, because the current Dr. Tedros from WHO is such a strong proponent of this, and he set up a youth hub, of which I'm a member as well, with my advocacy activities. And there's also a youth committee in the current COP 27. I think we are getting there slowly and surely. But there still needs to be done to, you know, bridge the intergenerational gap.
I fully agree. My daughter of 12 would love to call you. She always asks me why Bolsonaro won an election. Why did he get to chop off the Amazon rainforest? And then I ask her, where is the Dutch rainforest? Where is the Dutch forest? Where's the original forest in Europe? So we're giving Brazil a hard time for, you know, looking at their resources, but we don't have anything left of our own resources. But she's sharp, and she's 12. And she'll ask you those questions to be involved. So finding the narrative and finding that story, like you did with your 12-year-old niece, we should all, as scientists and researchers, do you have a way forward? It seems you're involved in a lot of networking, a lot of international collaboration. But how do you, you know, take it out of the bubble of the well-informed, the well-educated, the well-off relatively, and how do we enter into realms of real society where people have less access to that beautiful research that you do, or the stories that you've seen with your own eyes, or the lectures that you give? How do we actually involve the community, youth, elderly, less educated? How would you do that?
I think this is where you come in,
Ashish. Thank you.
Such a creative storyteller. I think you would help us do a good job translating our research and our activities in simple terms and explaining it to a 5-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 15-year-old, an 18-year-old. Oh, by the way, the 18-year-old girl, her name, she also told me that they are very eco nihilistic about climate change right now. Some of them have just not accepted it yet. So they're not all Greta Thunberg. they're still in denial, is what she said.
Obviously, I'm 51. There's many 51-year-olds who are in denial about climate change. But you said, I'll give it back to you again. I think that if you are a researcher, you do that with public funding or an NGO funding, and this is not to be critical, but it is to be real, that I think one of the things that we miss out in modern research is that storytelling gift. You're from a beautiful nation where Mahabharata, Ramayana has been ingrained into your veins. You know what a story is. You know how to depict. There's the hero's journey, which is a representation of how life is with obstacles. And I think all of us, researchers, doctors, but also engineers, we should be able to do this. So I put the challenge back to you. And I'm going to ask you to educate my 12-year-old daughter, who would love to talk with you about all the research that you've done around the world, because she's interested in becoming a journalist. And so how do you pick up the glove? Because you're working in international organizations, and how do you find the audience, but the like-minded? And first of all, I'm very happy you're talking with like-minded, but how do we expand the movement awareness about planetary health? How will we do that?
I would love to talk to your 12-year-old, by the way. She sounds like someone I really want to talk to, especially with her questions about rainforests. I find it so fascinating that such young people have such nice questions. And now coming to your main question. I think the most important part here is to just keep talking and explaining it and simpler terms than just being outspoken about what you're seeing, what wrongs you're seeing, and how it could be potentially, corrected. Bringing together people who may not see eye to eye on the same table might also bring great results, by the way. I've seen it firsthand. But then you need like a mediator between the two, because they don't see eye to eye, but they have great ideas. And I'm not being super modest right now, but I am a great mediator when it comes to bringing together two people who are not like-minded.
So it's basically about seeing the skill sets that we by natural skills have, or about what we've learned in our process and being exposed, you know, as a vice president of an international movement, working with international international non-governmental organizations like WHO, other organizations, universities around the world. I always believe that when you're exposed more, you have to be flexible. And to be flexible gives you a better way to connect. And I'd like to ask you something about equity. We skipped over it a little bit earlier, but why is equity in health access so important to you? And how could we achieve it in, you know, in the context of planetary health?
Great question.
It's a big question, I agree, but you take your time.
Yeah, let me think.
You know, it's the best thing you can do.
Maybe Janine has that answer.
Sometimes you just need to take your time to give an answer. That's wonderful. It's good that you're doing that. And I'm filling up the gap, the void of silence. And I'll just hear you answer the question next.
I think equity, planetary health. I think people need to stop working in silos. If you're in research, you only talk about research. If you're in academia, you only talk about academia. If you are working in an NGO, all you do is to talk about it. If you are in a civil society, that's what you do. So there are all these parallel conversations happening. And it could be about the same thing, you know, and it could be in different communities. And also comes from research from the so-called global north and global south and global east and global west. I don't know what the current hip trends are to talk about this, but what needs to happen right now is bringing together people who are working in these silos on the same table, no matter what their beliefs in planetary health, and working towards solutions.
Yeah, that what we sometimes call transdisciplinary approach.
Okay.
That's the hip term, I think, or that's what I call it, at least.
Probably the term.
But Leica. If you weren't a doctor, but if you were president of the Netherlands, for instance, for one day, what would your first new policy or program be about with all the knowledge that you have from global health, health equity, but also planetary health? It's a very big question, but I'm just very curious.
Can I be Secretary General of the United States?
Yes, you can. This is our show.
That's better.
And not for a day. We make it a whole year.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay, of course.
I think the first thing that I would do is bring together the G77, the small island states, representatives of these countries, all of them in a room, and put them together in a room for 48 hours with three questions, with three goals. One is to stop fossil fuels. Two is to reduce the global warming by at least 0.5 degrees. And stick to the Paris Agreement. And three would be to find a way to coexist. We're putting aside their egos, putting aside everything that makes them different, just finding common sense, I think. But I'm not sure if the Secretary General has that power.
Hey, you're the boss.
You're the boss.
You're the boss woman. You can do what you want. But it seems very humble goals, you know, like putting together those that are threatened in their life, in their lively existence. And then forcing them to actually stop talking and start acting on issues that are way, way, way overdue.
Yeah, I think it's about time that world leaders stop just telling people what they want to hear.
But that requires insight, Eka. That requires insight. That requires guts. And it's not something that our current wave of scientists seem to have, as they are very happy to look for their funding for their next research. And they're dependent, codependent perhaps. Maybe drama-bound or drama-triggered. It's hard to stand up and to stand out because the media will chop you into pieces, and if not the media, your scientific community. So may I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
I had an interview recently with somebody who talked about the participations of civilians, the civilian act, where people come together from a civil society who talk about complex issues, and they have what you say 7 days of priming in a period of about 2 months, and then in the eighth day they have to come with a plan that they will deliver, and Parliament has to acknowledge at least some and preferably all of these issues. So that's one methodology that will be very interesting. And the second one is what they do in Japan, which I really like. So they have these civilian meetings and political meetings, and people that represent the future generations, they get to have 25% of the vote. They don't exist yet, but somebody will represent them. And so their angle is definitely to make sure that we don't think about a sustainable world, but we think about a thrivable world where we really care for one another, and we don't think about 5-year cycles. We think about 50 years, 100-year cycles. Yeah. But then, I mean, I have to co-chair the United Nations Secretary General role with you. But that would be great.
Yeah, totally.
So that was a very nice question of Renee. I'm going to ask you if there's something you would like to share, what you wanted to talk about, in the realms of planetary health, or you want to ask Renee or me. Perhaps you have a question.
With all your travels around the world and working as a doctor around the world, how to you, as I can imagine, you have a very interesting background and might potentially, you know, clash. The backgrounds may potentially clash with each other at times. From the East and West, so to say. How does it feel for you to work in Asia and Africa, and how do you view equity as a result?
Well, so I ask you big questions, I get punished now. But between East and West, both are best. Between North and South, let me have both. There's beauty in all different ways, and there is no one North, there is no one South, there is no one East, and there is no one West. If you look at the diversity of life in India or in Africa, it is amazing to see. And what I see is that the vast majority of people are good people that are resilient, have a sense of humor, and they have a thrive, a will to do better. And that every society, we have 1 to 5% of people who are greedy, not willing to share, and unfortunately, because of their antisocial traits, they generally end up being political leaders or army leaders or business people that really don't care and extract. So there's a fine balance in becoming an angry old or young man and being somebody who is beyond anger and can actually say, well, this is the human condition. There can be no good without evil. There can be no evil without good. So I'd like to be a positive person. I'd like to see that if you want to see equity, you have to be the equity. It's very hard, but I work as a forensic medical doctor. I treat people who are murderers, rape victims, but also the rapists. And they don't ask for my judgment. And as a physician, you know very well, I am there not to harm my patients. So I will treat anyone who comes to me the way. So that's the grain, the inner motivation of doing the work. And now if you close your eyes and extend that suffering and that pain to the world, you could say, well, perhaps I have to be forgiving and humble. I'm just a human being. I have my anger, but I can't take it out on the world. So I better use a boxing ball.
That's beautiful.
That was beautiful.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yes. I let drop the silence. I think it's nice sometimes. We don't have to talk all the time. You know, it's I see somebody who comes from India and is working in Holland. So I have a question for you again. Two questions. Yeah. Well, I'll start with one first. Where are you in 5 and where are you in 15 years?
Okay. In 5 years, I'm working for United Nations, and I am a program officer for a health program. It could be UNHCR, or it could be UNRWA. It could also be UNICEF, also ICRC or IFRC. In 15 years, I have my own think tank, which aims to solve flooding in Mumbai and other parts of the world, and any other climate crises that affects health of humans acutely or chronically, because India is a country that is affected by disasters, not just in North, but also other parts of India. We have the Himalayas, the mighty Himalayas, which I love, where I spent all my summers, actually, now that I think about it. And I've seen landslides, I've seen people dying, I've seen cars going into rivers and valleys, and, you know, just a general loss of life. And I think if there's something I can do to prevent that, I want to be able to do it.
I'll meet you at the top of Kedarnath, I promise you. And I'll make you Luchi Aludom as a Bengali man. And
she's like, I cannot hear you. I can hear you well.
Oh, I said I will make you Luchi Aludom and I will meet you on the top of Kedarnath. I love the Himalayas as well. And what you see in India, I have seen with my own eyes in Rwenzori Mountains in Uganda. I've seen in South America. I've seen in global wetlands. I've seen in global mountains, rivers, estuaries, ocean systems. We are overreaching. And this is one of the reasons I do this series. I want to talk with young and old, wise and very sage people that actually put their life on the line or put their energy on the line to be committed to organizations, to be committed to people, and to be committed to the planet. And that seems that you're going to do that. So now we've talked about your career and our eating of Luchi Aludom. My question would be, so where is this world? You know, we have COP27 going on. Is this going to take us to COP28 with the same stories and we're going to make big words and little actions? Or this is finally the moment that we finance the change?
That's a good question. Did you know that I'm going to Egypt on Saturday?
I didn't get you.
I'm going to Egypt on Saturday.
You're going?
Yeah, I'm going on Saturday, yeah.
So are you going to activate the activists? Are you going to activate the politicians? Are you going to get involved in the World Economic Forum?
So I'm going as a WME, a World Medical Association delegate, and my aim is, and the delegation aim is going to be asking politicians, mayors, external stakeholders to put health into their NDCs and their national climate action plans. And for me, this COP27 is, there is some positive stuff that is coming out of it, at least some. And there's also a lot of promises that are being made by high-income countries to support the mitigation activities that are going on around the world. And I think a great area to start is the San Diego Network and the loss and damage financing. I think this has gained a lot of momentum because there's been positive developments in this area.
So, Lika, I'm going to ask you a final question. It's been 45 minutes almost of beautiful talk. The question is, are you going to blog now that you are a regular on all kinds of planetary health talk shows and talks? Are you going to share the experience you have with people there? Are you going to interview people to tell the story that is needed to be heard, not only by official media, but especially by beautiful people like you who care about the planet?
I am going to blog, and I'm going to make Twitter posts as well. I'm going to try to, because I am struggling a little bit as well. I'm a little overwhelmed, in all honesty, with everything that is going on. But I'm hanging in there, and I'm going to be making blog posts on LinkedIn and on Twitter. So
cool.
Keep an eye out.
We love it.
My focus this year is going to be on adaptation.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what would that mean for the layman or laywoman? What is the adaptation?
Climate adaptation. So how do we adapt to the changing climate? And how do we... there are three main points here. One is developing health metrics to measure progress on adaptation. So that would mean how humans are human health is being affected and measuring these metrics. Two is to raise adaptation ambition and ask cities and countries to focus on health co-benefits. For example, how to improve urban health.
Mm-hmm.
And three is to motivate political parties to have countries to have a dedicated health national adaptation plan.
On this high note and this very beautiful conversation, I'd like to say thank you. As I said, I have a small present wrapped up for you standing in front of me on the table. I shall have to find you in Utrecht, or I'll pass it on to Joyce.
I would love to meet you in Andrenée in person sometime.
It will happen. It will happen. It's a small world, and it will happen. Yeah. Do you know, you're going to live
here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it was a pleasure. We are going to finalize. This was the beautiful show by the Kenniscentrum Global Health from Utrecht. And I was here with Tessa René and our beautiful guest, Lika Rathad. I'm not pronouncing your name correct. This is horrible. But thank you very much for being here. Have a great one. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.